Blog Talk Radio.
Stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. It once again I'm locked up in memory, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening, good evening, good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us on Blog Talk Radio, Stop Child Abuse Now. We are on scan number 3414, and I'm your host tonight, Dr. Nancy. I see callers calling in, which is great. Thank you for joining us again tonight. We're on scan number 3414. And let me first start by reading what NASCA stands for. NASCA stands for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. Again, I'm your host, Dr. Nancy, tonight. And let me start by reading our NASCA mission statement. We have a single purpose at NASCA to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violence or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so with only two goals. One, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. And two, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to the adult survivors of child abuse. And information for anyone interested in many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. So we do have a special guest tonight. Anyone who's interested in joining our panel tonight is welcome to calling in the guest line. So let me make sure I mention this guest number. And the guest number here is 646-595-2118. Again, the guest number tonight is 646-595-2118. And I will start by introducing our guest. Tonight's special guest is Penny Lane from Mill Valley, California. Although she looks like a strong, vibrant woman, a happy wife and mother with a successful career, underneath, she is a damaged survivor of child abuse. Her young mother died of cancer when Penny was 6 months old. Her sister raised her until she was four, when the father, whom she did not know, took her to live with him and his new wife, who never wanted her. The stepmom was cold and told Penny that she was plain, unattractive, and ugly. She was required to help the new baby, but nothing she did was ever good enough. She could only eat what she was given and slept on a worn cot in a hallway. She was always hungry. As the stepmom's arthritis worsened, Penny had to take on household work as well. The mom snuck up, slapped her hard across her face, hit her with a wooden spoon or a pot, pushed her head into a wall, or used a belt buckle on her bare bottom, yelling how stupid, lazy, and good for nothing she was. Penny's father was never home to witness the beatings, and the stepmom tempered her malice when others were around. If Penny told anyone, the mom would beat Penny more and call her a liar. Unfortunately, the abuse continued for 15 years because she could not see she was being abused. Everyone tonight is welcome to join our panel. Again, you can visit NASCA.org. That's our website. Or you can call in the guest line number, which is 646-595-2118, to be a part of our panel tonight. I'm going to welcome our guest, Ms. Penny. It's such an honor to have you tonight. Reading your story was just, it was hard. It was hard to hear. And just to know that you went through that as a child, I just want you to know that our hearts are with you. And we're very proud of you for being brave and for rising up and for sharing your testimony. That's going to definitely save lives and help other survivors or other victims. Some people are going through it now. So, you know, I want to get a chance to allow you the opportunity to share your story. I normally like to start at the earlier part of the story, you know, as early as you can remember, because we have almost an hour and a half, so you have time. Just take us through a little bit of that earlier part of your life, please.
Thank you so much for that introduction, Nancy. I really appreciate it and your kind words. I'd love to thank the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse for having me on the program. I'm honored. I didn't even know such a thing existed until just recently. And as you mentioned, I was quite shocked to find myself in an abusive situation. My mother died, as you mentioned, when I was 6 months old. She had some kind of cervical cancer, which in those days, in the very late 50s, there was no cure. You found out you had it, and you just died. And my father was an immigrant. He was a single man. He had just come in 3 years in the country, so he didn't even speak English well. And he fell apart. He completely fell apart. So my mother's sister, my Aunt Charlotte, took me in. I was born in New York City. She lived in New Jersey, in Linden, New Jersey. She had two boys of her own, quite a bit older than my mother, who was only just 19 when she died. And so she took me in, raised me with her two boys, Georgie and Alex. We lived in a duplex with her brother, Uncle Buddy, and his wife, Mary, and their three kids. So as far as I knew, it was a very, very happy existence. I don't remember being unhappy. I felt secure and loved. And then one day, this strange man shows up on my driveway. I'm riding my tricycle on my driveway. And the strange man shows up and starts hugging me and kissing me and telling me he's my father. And I was like, ooh, get away from me. I don't know who you are. I've never seen you before. And as it turns out, he was my father. And he had remarried. I was now 4 years old, so it's 4 years later, 3.5 years after his wife died. And he came to pick me up and take me to live with his new wife and himself in California. And I didn't know him. Nobody had told me that this was going to happen. So, you know, you don't have much of a choice at that age. I was kind of, you can't really use the word kidnapped because he was legally my father. So he had the right to take me, but obviously I didn't want to go with a strange man. So my Aunt Charlotte got in the car with me and my father and another man who turned out to be my step-grandfather, and they took me in the car, and we said we were going to go visit my Uncle Georgie, at the train station where he worked. He was a ticket collector for the Pennsylvania Railroad, and when we got to the train station, Aunt Charlotte got out, and she said, I'll be right back, and the car drove off, and I didn't see my Aunt Charlotte again for 50 years. So that in itself was a lot of trauma, but that's not abuse, and that's not neglect, it's just trauma, and, you know, many people live with that, and I suppose I probably could have lived with that, and, you know, maybe asked for some answers. I was quite precocious. I asked questions. My father drove off with this man, who turned out to be my grandfather, my step-grandfather, so my stepmother's father, and took me on an airplane and flew me to California, and I met this woman, and they started speaking in a different language that I didn't know. They started speaking Hungarian. And so she wasn't very warm to me in the beginning. She wasn't mean. She just wasn't warm. And, you know, when you're a kid and you've been around a warm, loving person who gave you hugs, who was nice to you, you expect every adult to be that way. And so the stepmother was kind of, it was an adjustment for us. She said, you're going to need to speak Hungarian. We're going to speak Hungarian to you. You need to learn it. And so, okay. And, you know, luckily when you're 4 years old, you pick it up. You don't even know that you're learning it. You just start speaking it. And, you know, she'll say, go to bed. And then you, in Hungarian, and then you realize, oh, that's how you say go to bed, right? So that's how you learn it. And from the beginning, it was weird. It was, I don't know how else to say it. She would say things to me like, your straight hair is ugly. Or, you have freckles. Freckles aren't pretty. Stuff like that. Because in Europe, they have a different idea of what beauty is. And in Europe, Shirley Temple is what's beautiful. Blonde, curly hair, pure porcelain skin, precocious, pretty dresses. And I was skinny and knobby knees, and big elbows, and bony shoulders. And I wasn't that cute little dumpling of a girl. That just wasn't me. But we got along, and we, you know, nothing bad happened at first. And then my stepbrother was born when I was 4 and a half, so about a half a year later. And, you know, it's wonderful having a baby in the house, right? Everybody's happy. Babies are cute. They're fun to be around. They come with toys and teddy bears. And you get to be special and give them your bottle and help out, right? But soon it was my job to do a lot of stuff, and I was, by this point, 5, you know. Then it was time for me to go to kindergarten. Now, luckily, kindergarten was a really big, big thing. Because guess what? In kindergarten, I didn't do anything wrong. Everything was great. Teachers loved me, made friends. I was a good kid. I was a good student. I had no problems at all. I loved it. I excelled in school. As a matter of fact, the teacher said to me, you're so smart, we're going to put you in first grade, and you get to stay in school all day. If kindergarten is half day, first grade is all day. I was so happy. When I went home and told my mom, she said, you know what, we're moving to New York, so you're not going to first grade. And we were moving back to New York where her family lived because she needed help with the baby, wanted help with the baby. So we moved to New York, and before long, unbeknownst to me, because I'm 4 years old, so now I'm speaking with my adult voice, I'm 5 years old, my stepmother had arthritis. And this arthritis got really bad. It got worse and worse and worse. She was a young woman. When I look back, she was maybe only 20 years old at this time. She married young. She married to get out of her house. I didn't know this at the time. I found out later in life. So she was in a lot of pain. Again, I'm 5 years old at this point. We moved to New York City. We moved to the Bronx. And I get enrolled in school. I start first grade. And I'm given chores. And I'm given things to do. So I go to school. In the morning, she's still in bed. I have to get myself off to school. Or she tells me time to go to school from the bedroom. I go to school. And again, I love school. And I'm the teacher's pet. I'm a great student. I'm having a great time. I make friends with everybody. And when I get home, I'm late. What took you so long to get home? And she sends me to the store. And, you know, again, now I'm 6 years old, right? And I get sent to the supermarket or the bakery. And maybe I got the wrong kind of bread. Or maybe I forgot the flour. Or maybe I got the wrong thing. And so no matter what I could do, it was just never right. I didn't hold my brother right. I was not careful with him. I was told to sweep the kitchen floor, and she'd come in after and she'd find some speck on the floor or some dust on the floor. And she got the wooden spoon out. She said, put your hands out. Put my hands out. and she hit my hands with the wooden spoon. And sometimes she hit the back of my thighs, because those days, early 60s, we mainly wore dresses. You didn't wear pants yet at that time to school. You know, stuff like that. And my mom, she never did this in front of other people. So when my dad got home, she might talk harshly to me, but she never hit me. But she was kind of sly about it. She had all kinds of rules for me that she told me when my father wasn't home. I wasn't allowed in the living room where the family was. So whenever the family was together, I needed to be in the hallway where my cot was, or there was a little table and chairs. Or I was to be in the kitchen, sitting at the kitchen table doing homework. I wasn't allowed in their bedroom where my baby brother slept with my mother. So it was a weird relationship, and because there were so many rules, and because I was always in trouble, I started becoming a very timid and scared person, was afraid to do anything, or afraid to take initiative, afraid to ask for anything, because either I was told no, or I was told I was doing something wrong. So I started forming this identity of, A, trying to please people, but being scared because nothing I did was ever right. So I've given away a little bit of my book here, but there's this one time I got sent to the store to a bakery where, you know, my parents were Eastern European and they liked rye bread and they liked it really fresh. And you had to go to the Jewish bakery to get this rye bread. So I go to this Jewish bakery, I get the rye bread, and it's a fun experience going to bakery because they're always nice to children, and they sneak you a cookie that you eat really quickly before you get home so mom doesn't know you got a cookie. And that particular day, I was really hungry. So I don't know if you've ever seen rye bread from a bakery, but it's kind of an oval-shaped loaf. It's fat in the middle and skinnier at the end. I was really hungry this day, and the loaf of bread was warm. So when I got the package and held it against my chest, it was still warm from the oven, and I thought, ooh, this is really good. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to take a slice from the middle of the bread and the middle of the loaf. I'm going to take a slice and eat it before I get home, and nobody will know. At this point, I'm maybe 6 or 7, and I take it, and it's so good. It's delicious, and I'm this happy-go-lucky kid when I'm outside on the street. I skip. Kind of skip to my Zoom as I go down the street, and I say hi to people. And it's a vibrant neighborhood. We live in a tenement, you know, 10 apartments on a floor, 6 floors, 10 of these buildings on the block, or 4 or 5, I don't know. And on each corner, there's stores. So I say hi to people that I see every day, right? Because you walk the same streets every day. And I'm happy-go-lucky, and I get home, and I hand her the bread, I hand her the change, and she says, "Did you have a piece?" And as soon as she said that, my heart drops into my stomach, and I know I'm in trouble because I wasn't supposed to. We had a rule. You never take food unless it's given to you or you ask for it. And I stopped asking because, you know, we didn't have a lot of food. We had food, but we didn't have a lot. So there wasn't a lot of, we didn't have a lot of money for a lot of food. So I knew I had to lie. I knew I had to lie. I can't admit. And she got really mad at me really fast when I said, no, I didn't. And she used to hit me with one of the wooden dowels from my brother's crib. It must have fallen out. And she was able to, like, ran into the bedroom. The house, the apartment's small, 4 feet away, 5 feet away. Ran into the bedroom, got the dowel, and started hitting me. And so I was cowering like this. And she hit me, and it struck right here at my hairline, and I started bleeding. And the whole time she's hitting me, she's calling me a liar. Then once the blood, you know, I don't know if you've ever been hit on the head, but, like, it bleeds a lot, and it squirts. It kind of squirts. And it squirted all over the walls, which were painted, you know, it's like this antique white walls in New York City apartments. They're all the same. Every apartment I've ever been to is the same kind of color. And it started going everywhere on the linoleum and on the walls. And then she started getting mad about that. So, you know, what do? You just say, I'm sorry. And then she realized what's happening. She got a rag and she had me hold it on my head. And then she went in the kitchen and got a bottle of 409 cleaner and handed it to me and said, clean up that mess type of thing. So that was that. And, you know, we're traumatized. I'm shaking. My head's bleeding. I'm cleaning up as best as I can. And, you know, blood's not an easy thing to clean up off of white walls or white linoleum. It was the kind of linoleum with the little speckles in it. So next thing we do, we go in the bathroom. She puts a Band-Aid over my head. She wipes off the blood, puts the Band-Aid on my head. The whole time she's muttering and cursing in Hungarian, calling me all kinds of names that I didn't know, right? I'm 6 or 7. I'm probably 7. I don't know. She's calling me a word like bastard. Well, I didn't know what that was. What does a kid know? And she tells me, she points over to the toilet. And above our toilet in the bathroom is a big windowsill. And the window ledge is like a foot deep, so you could have stuff on the windowsill. She says, you tell your father you fell off that windowsill and you fell onto the toilet pipe. You do not tell your father what happened. And she didn't threat. I don't remember a threat. I don't remember her saying, or else. You just knew. You knew in your stomach that if you told, you'd be in trouble. So that day, you know, it's already dark when my father comes home. My father runs his own gas station in Queens, which is a different borough. I don't know how long it takes him to get home, but it's already dark. It's dark in the apartment. He says hello to me. He says the same thing every night. He says, hello, chicken. I say, hello, Dad. He might give me a peck on the cheek, but that's it. He doesn't notice the Band-Aid. He doesn't notice that I've been crying. He doesn't notice that I'm trembling. I'm afraid. And I don't know. I'm assuming he's going to take care of me. I'm assuming he's going to say, what happened? But guess what? He doesn't say a thing. He doesn't say a thing at all. So the next morning, I wake up before everybody. He's gone. He always leaves before I get up. He's gone. I go to the bathroom to wash my face, and I'm in shock. I don't know if you've ever had blood on your forehead before, but when blood goes in your eyes, guess what you have? You have two black eyes now. So now I have a Band-Aid on my forehead and two black eyes. Again, I'm 7 years old, and I'm like, oh, shit. What am I going to do? Sorry about that. I don't know. So I get myself ready for school. I don't remember like what I did. Get myself ready to school. I leave my house. I walk to school on my own. It's not very far, 3 or 4 blocks, but I've never felt unsafe before. It's the 60s, the early 60s. But again, I'm in a very crowded neighborhood, lots of shops on the streets that I pass. People know me. I'm not afraid. But guess what? Nobody in the elevator on the way down to the lobby. We live on the 6th floor. Nobody on the street. Nobody says a word to me. Penny, what happened to you? Nobody says a word. And I get to school, and my teacher doesn't say a word. But, you know, I don't know if you remember, but if you're an abused child, you have a lot of fantasies in your head. You think, my teacher's going to say, what happened to you? They're going to call the police. The police will come to the door. My mother's going to get in trouble. They're going to take me somewhere else. I'm going to live with a nice lady. I'm going to have a bed with a canopy, good food, and nice clothes. But guess what? I get to school, and nobody says anything. Not my teachers, not the gym teacher, not the lunch lady, not the principal. Nobody says a thing. I walk home. Not a person says a single thing. And I realized at 7 that there is nobody going to protect me. Nobody. It took my father 3 or 4 days to notice if there was anything wrong with me. Now, meanwhile, I didn't have bangs when I was a kid. I just had my hair parted on the sides like this, so people could have seen it. And when he finally notices, we're in the kitchen, all of us. My baby brother's in the high chair, my mother's at the sink, and I'm in the kitchen. And my dad says, come here. And I'm scared. And he says, what happened to you? And he's gruff. He's not gentle like you are with the kids that's hurt. He's like, what happened to you? And I said, I look at my mom, and I said, I fell off the window. Which window? The bathroom window. And he says to me, "You're lying. I hate liars." And he starts shaking me, holds me by my shoulder, starts shaking me, and says, "You're lying." And I can't tell him any different because she's right there, and she told me to lie to him. And if I don't lie, then when he leaves for work tomorrow morning, who knows what will happen to me. So this is just one type of incident of what happened. Eventually, he finds out. He makes me tell him. We drive to New Jersey to visit an aunt and an uncle, and he takes me out of the car, and he tells they stay in the car, my stepmother and my stepbrother. And he pulls me behind the bushes where she can't see me, and he kneels down in front of me, so he's my height, and he says, "I'm the only one who loves you. You need to tell me what happened, because I can't help you if you don't tell me." And so I tell him everything. I tell him how she's mean to me, how she sometimes doesn't give me food, how she's nasty to me, how she hits me, and he says, he gets up, drives me back to the car. We get back in the car. He doesn't say a whole thing. It's about half hour, 40-minute drive back to our home. Never says another thing about it. Nobody ever talked to me about it. Nothing ever changed. So this kind of stuff went on all the time. Lots and lots and lots of little stories. But more importantly, the thing that matters to me now is that it created this fearful person. This fearful person that was afraid of everybody, afraid to ask for help, afraid to look her in the eye. Obviously, you wouldn't look her in the eye and say, "Why are you doing this?" Afraid of my father because he's gruff with me even when I'm not bad, quote unquote. I'm told that I'm bad. I'm told that I'm stupid. I'm told that I'm lazy. I'm told that I'm good for nothing. And this continues. And there's other little microaggressions. Some of these I talk about in my book because, you know, you can't keep talking about your abuse. People get worn out. But, like, here's a little story. In third grade, we were going on a field trip to the library. Now, I loved books and I loved reading. And we didn't have a lot of toys at home. I didn't have a lot of stuff. It was mainly whatever toys or money we had. It was for my stepbrother, right? Because he was her pride and joy, and he was their kid together and that kind of thing. So I brought home this permission slip to go on the field trip, and she didn't sign it. But come the day of the field trip, the teachers didn't like single me out. They just took the whole class. We went on the field trip. It was a big, beautiful building. Like in the school, elementary school, you have a little library, right? It's one room. It's like your school room, but with books on the shelves, right? But this library was huge. It had big, giant windows and tons of books and a beautiful librarian with cat glasses. She wore high heels, and she was so sweet. She gave us this little talk, and she said, "We're going to give each of you your own library card with your name on it, and you can take home 10 books. 10 books. I've never had 10 books at one time. I was so happy. I was in love with the librarian, and I was in love with the library. I was so happy. So that day, I got my little library card with my name on it. I put it in the little pocket of my book bag, the little snap pocket on the outside. I skipped home, skipped to my room, skipped all the way home. I was so happy. As soon as I got in the door, I felt icicles. I felt the hair on the back of my neck pop up, and I said, oh, my mother was waiting for me in the hallway. And she said, tell me about school today. And I was like, wow, she has never, ever, I'm in third grade, she has never asked me about school before. So I tried to, well, we did phonics, and we did math, and we did reading, and went to the gym. And I didn't know this was what it was called, but I'm procrastinating. Finally, I said, then we went to the library, and I got a library card, and she snatches my bookcase away from me violently. She starts tearing stuff away. She said, where is it? Where is that library card? And I said, what, Mom? Please don't. I love the library. Please don't take my library card. I like the library. And she started cursing in Hungarian, all kinds of stuff about, I can't even tell you what, because I didn't understand those kind of words. She found my library card and she tore it up. Again, now I don't know how old you are in third grade, 8 years old, and I didn't understand it and she didn't explain to me. I think her anger was that I went to the library without her permission, but the teachers took all the kids. The whole class went. Nobody stayed behind. And I didn't know it was even Library Day. You know, as a kid, you don't know today's Library Day unless somebody at home tells you. You know, when you get to school, the teacher says, today we're going to the library, right? So those kind of things happened all the time, and I didn't understand that at the time. But when I look back, I think, well, maybe she didn't want me to be smart. Maybe she didn't want me to be learned. Maybe she didn't want me to have any advantages, because maybe in her world, it was all about my stepbrother. And anything that I had somehow in her mind, maybe, and I'm guessing here, I'm admitting, I'm guessing, maybe in her mind it took away from him. I don't know. But those are the kind of things that happened. He got toys and books and nice clothes. I got hand-me-down clothes. I slept on a hand-me-down cot. I had nothing of my own. No books, no toys. When I had downtime, which is a term we didn't use back then, when I was done with my chores and done with my homework, I just sat in a dark hallway and I waited to be called upon to watch him or do some sort of chore. So do you want me to pause and see if there's callers, or do you want me to keep going? Dr. Nancy, you tell me.
Again, I just want to say thank you so much for sharing your story. I mean, that was hard to hear, you know, to see that little girl. Like, sometimes it's good to put ourselves in that mind frame of that child. And that must have been a really hard time, a really sad time. I was curious, and we're going to open up the lines in a second. You know, how did you feel during that time? Like, did you feel any sense of, well, obviously I know you felt some rejection, but, like, not love? Like, they love him, they don't love me. Did your father treat your brother different than you, or was it just the stepmother that did the favoritism?
They as a family focused on him. So it wasn't, my father, it was more like he ignored me and neglected me. He did whatever the stepmother, you know, any kind of arrangements. Later on in life, when I'm older, when I'm like 12, she would arrange these like little vacations to like a dude ranch or something. And she would have my father drop me off at this aunt and uncle's house in New Jersey so that she could vacation alone with just my brother and father. Now, unbeknownst to her, I loved it at my aunt and uncle's, which is a story for later because I'm a little older, but they loved me and they treated me so well. And they must have known what was going on because they were extra special to me. They bought me coloring books and crayons and toys and gifts and took me to visit the neighbors and bought me clothes. They were so good. For those 2 weeks, I was in heaven. And it was like, I didn't know this term then. I don't even think people use the term, but it was like validating that this is what it's supposed to be like. This is how you're supposed to be treated. So I didn't even tell my half-brother about this, even though by this time he's, you know, I'm 12, he's 7. We're kind of friends. I didn't tell him because I knew if my stepmother found out, she'd put an end to it, even if it meant taking me along. So my father, just to answer your question, just kind of was oblivious. He was oblivious. And I felt very, very alone and confused because when you're 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 or 10, you really don't understand why this is happening. You're not old enough to understand that maybe she was jealous or never wanted me. I didn't know that at the time. I heard that later. Like, she would say things like in front of me in the car with my brother, my sweet child, the only child I ever wanted. And, you know, we would look at each other because he's old enough to understand what she just said. And he looks at me, but he doesn't say anything. And my father's in the car. But he just, it was like benign neglect. He wasn't necessarily abusing me himself, but he certainly wasn't loving me or protecting me. And so I felt alone. I felt very alone.
I want to open up the mic just in case. I know we have a couple of listeners. Sometimes people call in just to listen, and sometimes they have a question. So I'm going to open up the mic. If your background is loud, please mute yourself. But the mics are open, and you're welcome to join in if you would like to share some words of support for Ms. Penny, or if you have a question. Mics are open.
Hi, this is Philip. I'd just like to thank you for sharing your story because it's making me stronger.
Thank you for your kind words. We have another caller. Not sure if, you know, again, sometimes people call in just to listen and be supportive, or they're not ready to talk. You know, they're just listening, and that's okay. But, again, the mic is open, so if you'd like to join us, please feel free to speak now. Okay, I'm going to mute the mics again, and we'll come back to our panel in just a little bit. So, you know, Penny, I cannot imagine what you must have been going through. This sounds like a nightmare, to be quite honest with you. So now you said your aunt and uncle, this is from your father's side?
Mother's side.
From your mother's side, okay. And they treated you like gold, and those were some beautiful memories. Were there any other people? Like, I know you said you were in school. I know you talked about kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade, third grade. But did you ever, like, have a friend in school or someone during those times that you just said, because I know you told your dad. Was he the only person you told?
Uncle that I saw later in life, not the person who raised me. That was my father. Sorry, that was my father's brother. They lived in Englewood. I think early on I must have told somebody else in my step family that I wasn't happy, or they saw it on my face and asked me, and I said something like, you know, Mama was mean to me, and it got back to her somehow. And her response was that she called me a liar and said, don't you dare talk to anybody about what goes on here. You're a liar. You're a bastard. You're a good for nothing. You're lazy. You deserve everything you get. And so I never again told anybody in the family, and I didn't bother telling anybody in school because I regularly went to school. I mean, I just told you guys one incident with the black eyes and the Band-Aid on my forehead, but I regularly went to school with, like, nail marks in my face or on my neck or crying, and, you know, nobody did anything anywhere, not in the building. But I think that they knew. My stepmother's sister lived across the street, and I heard when I was older and I was playing with the cousins, because my stepmother's sister, my aunt, had a couple of kids. And when I was playing with the cousins, one of the cousins told me that her mom, my step-aunt, wanted to adopt me when I first moved in with my stepmother. So that told me that she must have known that things were not right. They sensed that things were not right, and she offered to adopt me, but my father said no. So a cousin told me this. So that told me that they knew something was going on, but they didn't intervene. And then later in life, later when we had moved to Queens, my father wasn't making enough money to support us. So when it came time to making dinner, and we lived in the inner city, so we didn't, you know, like now we get in the car, we drive to the supermarket, we buy a week's worth of groceries. It wasn't like that. We went to the grocery store every day and got just the meat and the vegetables for that day. Like, we didn't have money, or it wasn't done back in those days. And my stepmother at this point couldn't walk out of the house very far, so I did the grocery shopping. So she might give me, you know, get some bologna, get bread, get some chicken for, you know, that sort of thing. Like, you got a day's worth of food. You didn't get a bunch of days. So she'd send me over to her mother's house, who lived around the corner, for money, for groceries. And she'd say, when you get the money from grandma, you go and you get, you know, she'd give me a list of things to get. When I'd get there, my step-grandmother, but we didn't say step, I just said my grandma gave me the money. She'd ask me about my dad. What's your dad not earning enough money? And I said, I don't know, Grandma. Mom just sent me over to get some. And she'd say, your dad, he, you know, can't ever earn a living, that sort of stuff. And then she'd say, here's a dollar for you. You don't tell your mother about this. You hear me? Go buy yourself some food or candy. Go buy yourself some candy. Or she'd give me some food if she had some, like kid food, you know, a donut or a cookie. And we weren't rich. Like, people didn't have, like, tons of food in the house like we do these days, but people had food. They were chubby people. They were not skinny, right? I was super skinny. So I was hungry all the time. I can't tell you why. I don't remember a lot of details. I do remember there were times where I didn't eat for a few days when my dad went hunting over a weekend and for 3 or 4 days, and she'd be mad that he left and didn't leave her any money. So she'd say, you're not eating. This is my food. And when I came home, when he came home, I'd say to him in a real trembling voice, because I was scared, she's in the house. She can hear me. We are in a small apartment. I'd say, Dad, I'm hungry. I haven't eaten. And he'd say, you haven't eaten all this time? I'd say, I haven't eaten since you left. And he'd go in the fridge and he'd say, or he'd say to her, woman, why aren't you feeding her? And she'd grudgingly, like, take some cream cheese or some bread out of the fridge and say, here's the stuff you bought. She can eat this. But he would not address the issue, which is that there's a child under 10 years old who hasn't eaten for 3 days in your care. Never addressed it. Never talked about it. Never, like, next time he went hunting, said, I better not leave her here. Maybe I better take her with me. Maybe she'd be safe with me in the woods. Never happened. So that tells me now, as an adult, as I look back, it tells me my father knew, my aunt knew, my grandmother knew, but nobody did anything about it. So, and later in life, so now I'm 14, I'm going to skip around a little bit. Let's skip to when I'm 12. When I'm 12, we move to a new neighborhood. I start a new middle. I'm going to start in a new middle school, and my sixth grade teacher sends me home. She pulls me aside and she says, "Penny, you are doing really, really well. I want you to take this note home to your mother, and I'm recommending you for a special progress program for junior high school. Special progress means you can either take college prep classes in middle school, classes that will get you ready for college, or you can take a commercial degree with typing and stenography, and you can skip a year and get out of high school early," she said. "But I think you're smart enough to go to college. So I want you to take this home and have your mom sign it to get you into the special program." So I was like, oof. A little scared, like, what's going to happen here? And because, you know, my stepmother regularly got mad at me for anything I asked for, extra time for homework, a trip to the library, clothes, not, like, she didn't want to spend any money on me. I think I got the impression that it was more than an impression. I'm trying to be kind. she wanted to make me, she wanted to give me as little benefit as possible. By this point, I had a baby sister too. So we had a baby in the house. I'm about 12 years old. And I came home. My sister was asleep. My brother was in his room. And I waited for a commercial. The TV was always on. She was watching Days of Our Lives. And I waited for a break, commercial break. And I said, Mom, I have something to ask you. My teacher says I'm really smart. She's recommending me for this special program. I can take extra credit college level classes in middle school to prepare for high school and college. I'd like you to sign this form. She needs you to sign this form for me. And she laughed at me. She laughed in my face. But it was a weird laugh, the kind of laugh where you know somebody's not really laughing. Funny, ha-ha. She said, you're too stupid to go to college. You're going to work. But she said work like it was a curse. You're going to work. And she crossed out the college bound part of the form, and she signed the commercial degree part of it, which meant I was forced to take typing and stenography in middle school and for the next middle school and high school to get a commercial degree. And I was devastated. I hated it from day one. Hated typing, not coordinated, hated stenography, hated office systems. I could never, and, you know, that came with a package of goods. Everybody remembers how traumatic middle school is, right? I was skinny. I wasn't developing properly. The rest of the girls were developing. They were starting their cycles. I wasn't starting. They got sleepovers. They got pretty haircuts. They started wearing makeup. They started dating. They started talking about boys. Not allowed to do any of that stuff. They were joining glee clubs. They were joining a theater club. They were taking French after school. Nuh-uh. Went straight to school, went straight home, and started my chores. Got to bathe my sister, got to feed her, got to take the laundry to the basement, got to go grocery shopping. When all that's done, 6 or 7 o'clock, I could sit down and do my homework. And when she thought I was should be done, she'd say, you're done with your homework. Put your books away. And if I said, Mom, I'm not done. I have a test tomorrow. She'd say, I said you're done with your homework. Don't you talk back to me. You put your books away. And there was nothing else to do. The house was clean. The dishes were done. The shopping's done. The baby's in bed. But I still wasn't allowed to do my homework. I didn't understand it. It was craziness. I couldn't figure out. I didn't do anything wrong that day. It wasn't like I sassed her, so she punished me. There was no logic, and it made me crazy. It made me depressed. It made me, and of course, I was doing bad in steno and typing. So here, up till sixth grade, I was a star student. Never did anything wrong. I always raised my hand, read in front of the class, always knew the answer. And here I was now, my first year of junior high. I'm failing because at home, I have this anxiety and this depression sinking in. I can't do anything right. I can't please her. I can't. And then I get to school, and I can't do it right there either now because I don't want to type, and I don't want to be in stenography. We don't even use stenography anymore. That might be an old-fashioned term if there's any young listeners on. Stenography is how they used to do before we had recording devices. Somebody would speak, and you would put little shorthand, like a little script on a pad, on these things called steno pads that I still use today. I use them to take notes, but they look something like this. This is what a steno pad looks like. And reporters use it because they have really short lines, and so you can write a whole sentence really short like that. That's what a steno pad looks like. So anyway, now it's called a reporter's pad. But so that's what it was like. So I started thinking about suicide. The problem was I didn't have access to drugs or guns. Like, it's different. It was a different world back then. Like, you know, I didn't hang out with kids that used drugs, and I don't think they used drugs yet in middle school. I don't remember because I wasn't allowed to, like, hang out and associate, and I was not the cool kid. Kids made fun of me. I got bullied at school. I never had nice clothes. So I got, you know, I didn't know how to get drugs. I didn't know how to get alcohol. that was before guns. This was late 60s, early 70s. I thought about jumping off the roof of my building because we lived on we went up to the sixth floor. I had access to the roof. But when I looked off the edge of the roof, I realized down there on street level, there was a privet, like a row of cushions under the building, around the perimeter of the building. And what did I know? I said, ooh, if I fall into the privet and I don't die and I break my arm, she's going to be really mad at me. So I didn't jump because I didn't know if I would really die, and I couldn't risk not dying. And then I thought, we had some really cold winters in New York City. I don't know if anybody on the call is from New York City, but it's windy. That wind howls cold in New York City. And when I went out, when I wasn't going to school, I wasn't allowed to wear a winter coat. I was forced to go out in a sweater. Again, why? I can only guess. She was sicker and sicker. Her arthritis was worse and worse. My brother was kind of sickly. He always had ear infections, and he was sick a lot. Maybe she wanted me to get sick as him, but I was never sick. I was healthy as an ox. So she made me go out in a sweater, and one time I had to walk to a faraway pharmacy that was in our old neighborhood. And it was a long walk. I want to say like maybe 10 or 12 city blocks. And I thought, and I passed through a park. It was cold. The park was deserted. There was nobody in the park. And I thought to myself, I'm just going to sit here on this park bench. And it's so cold, I'm just going to wait to die. That's how I'm going to die. And while I sat there, you know how kids, again, kids' imagination. Instead of thinking about, I didn't believe in heaven or we didn't have any religion, or hell, I didn't believe in any of that stuff. And so I just thought, they'll be so mad, they'll be so sorry that they did this to me, they'll be so sorry I'm not around to do their work anymore. That's how kids think, right? But I realized it was getting darker, and it was getting darker because in New York City in the winter, it starts getting dark like 3:30, 4 in the afternoon. And I'm realizing it's getting dark, and I have no concept of time. I don't have a watch. So I think, damn it, I better get to that pharmacy. This isn't working. I might not die. So I got up, walked to the pharmacy, walked back home. That was the end of that. And the next thing I did was I ran away from home. And that was pretty successful. I was away. I rode my bicycle 30 miles to Hicksville, Long Island, because I remember seeing when we were driving on the Long Island Expressway that there was a shopping center. And in the middle of the shopping center was a great big Sears store. And I said to myself, I'm going to run away to that shopping center just because I didn't know where else to go. And it was in November. It was Tuesday. It was cold. But we started school late. We started school. By then I was in high school at 14 because I skipped a grade in junior high. And I left the house around 10:30 because school started at 11. And I was supposed to get out of school around 5. And I rode my bike. It took hours and hours. And I got to Long Island. I got to this Sears in Hicksville, Long Island. I parked my bike. I locked it up. Found a grocery store. I had some money that I had saved from what my grandmother gave me, and I'd taken a few bucks out of my dad's pocket. And I bought some bagels. I bought some apples. And then it was starting to be Christmas time, middle of November. So I went into the Sears store. It was really warm in the Sears. I don't know if you remember, but sometimes when you walk into a department store, there's like a heater right above the door. And nice and warm. I started walking around the Sears store. I started looking at clothing and went upstairs is where the furniture was. I liked being in the store. It was dark out. It was dark by now. And then I heard an announcement. And the announcement said, store closing in 10 minutes. And at this point, I was in the hardware section. And I was walking around. I was walking through like lawnmowers and rakes and shovels. And all of a sudden, I'm in this department where there's these great big wardrobe cabinets. like you would have in your garage when you have your brooms in it and your cleaning supplies. And the door was open, and I looked around, and again, I'm 14. I'm about 5'4". And I can fit in that cabinet. And I look around, and I thought, ooh, my stomach starts to tingle. And I, just to be sure, I do a circuit around the whole department. There is not a soul around. I get into that wardrobe. I close the door. I sit down, and I wait. And all of a sudden, and you can see the light under the door. And then all of a sudden, the lights get dimmer. The more time passes, the lights get dimmer. And it gets dark. And I had found my place to sleep for the night. So I was gone for 5 days. 5 days I slept in a department store. And in the morning I'd get up, I'd wait till I hear people. I'd tiptoe out of the store, go to the grocery store, and I'd buy cheap food like bagels back then. A bagel was like 25 cents. Or an apple, I liked apples. There was a movie theater in the mall. So I went to the movies. Nobody ever said a thing. Why is a young teenager on her own in the movies in the middle of the week? Nobody said a thing. And the fifth day, I made a mistake. I got out too early. In the store, somebody in the store took me to security. And I at first lied and said, oh, no, I didn't run away. Oh, no, I didn't sleep in your store. I snuck. I came in early. The door was open. And they didn't believe me, and they didn't believe me. And while I was in the store, I did something I'm not proud of. I stole some clothes, and I took the labels off. I threw away all my raggedy clothes, and I was wearing nice clothes when they found me. And I had nice clothes in my backpack because I had stole some more clothes. So when I told them that when I finally confessed that I ran away because my parents were mean to me, my mother beat me, they didn't believe me. They said, look, you've got nice clothes on. And I said, my grandmother bought it for me. They said, I don't know. I didn't have any bruises that they could see, and I wasn't about to pull my pants down and show them the bruises on my backside, right? So they didn't believe me. Finally, I told them, and they said, you're not in trouble. This happens all the time. We'll just call your dad, and he'll take you home. But that's not what I wanted. I wanted them to call Child Protective Services, although I didn't know that term at the time. I just wanted them to call the police, but they wouldn't do it because they saw no visible signs, and they didn't believe what I had to say. So they called my dad, and my dad's angry. It takes him about an hour to get there, and he's huffing and puffing because he had to interrupt his work day, right? I interrupted his work day. He had to come get me. I'd been gone a week at this point, and I didn't know this at the time. He told me later, but he had looked all over for me. He went to the school himself and looked at every room in the building, and he went back to my aunt and uncle, my Aunt Charlotte, who raised me. This is the first time I've ever heard about them since he took me away at 4 years old. So for 10 years, we never talked about my aunt. And I didn't know my aunt's last name. I didn't know how to get in touch with them. And my stepmother certainly didn't want to talk about it. So picks me up. He's mad. Tells me to get my bike, throws it in the car. He's not talking to me. I'm sitting as close to the door as I can, so afraid he doesn't hit me. He didn't hit me much, but he hit me occasionally. Finally, we're getting close to home, and he says, why'd you do it? And I tell him everything. I tell him how she hits me. She calls me names. She doesn't give me food. She calls me terrible things. She makes me go out without a sweater on in the winter. She won't let me do anything. I said I'm miserable. I cry all the time. I can't take it anymore. Please let me live anywhere else. And he says, his standard answer is, don't worry, I'll take care of it. That's his standard answer. And we get home, and I'm petrified. He drops me off at home, and he leaves. And now I'm home alone with his stepmother. And I know she sits in a recliner all day. Nobody's done the housework. Nobody's done the groceries. Nobody's cleaned the house. I'm scared to death that she's going to kill me. I literally am thinking, this is the worst thing I've ever done. And she's really quiet. And she tells me to sit on the couch, which is unusual because I'm not allowed to sit on the couch. I'm only allowed to sit on the floor or the kitchen table and chairs. So I sit on the couch and, you know, I'm a timid kid, so I'm doing this. Why'd you do it? And I said to her, I told her, you're mean to me. You hit me all the time. You beat me. You treat my sister and brother, you treat them well, and you treat me horribly, and I can't take it anymore. And she says, go to your room. And that's the end of that. Or I thought it was the end of that. But, you know, people started paying attention to me now, the step-grandmother and the step-aunt. They were coming over, glad I'm home. And my Aunt Charlotte's family demanded to see me because they said, we haven't seen her in 10 years. Except when I went to visit them, Aunt Charlotte wasn't around. I don't understand what happened. I don't know. But I stayed with my Uncle Buddy. That's her brother that lived in the downstairs apartment. And his wife, Mary, and his daughter, also called Mary. I stayed with them. And I had a great time. And I felt like a normal teenager. They played music and drove around with their friends in the car. You know, it was great. But when I went back a week later, my stepmother was angry. She was angry that I got special treatment, that I ran away, that I harmed the family, and I hurt my sister by leaving, and she was just a baby, and she was all confused, and I'm getting special treatment. So it was back to the way it was before, maybe worse. So that's how it was until I left, and I left again at 16. No sense in going into the detail, which is more of the same. But I left again at 16. I climbed out of the window. I ran away from home. We were a second-story window. I climbed out. My friends were waiting for me downstairs. And by friends, I mean the kids that lived on my street. They actually lived across the street from me. And they kind of knew what was going on. I had finally confided in them because it's hard to keep this stuff in. I had told by then I had a couple of friends. But nobody could do anything about it. Nobody had the means. It was a working-class neighborhood. It's not like anybody's parents were police or lawyers. They just, you know, those people across the street, they didn't have a father. My other friend, her father worked in a button factory. Her mother was a stay-at-home mom. They were immigrants. Nobody knew what to do about this, if they even believed me. I don't know if they did. Went to a giant high school, lots of kids. People ignored me. Nobody even looked at me. I was a misfit. Ugly, shy, nervous. But I ran away again. And I finished high school on my own. I finished high school at 16 and a half. I was living with these people across the street. I paid $20 a week rent and a job and a little five and dime. And once I graduated, I got a full-time job at the IHOP working as a waitress. And the worst part of all this is you don't realize how this trauma affects you. You think, oh, you're gone now. So now you're safe. Well, are you? Are you safe? But all you know is these people that you're living with aren't beating you. You don't know if they're using you. You don't know if they're manipulating you. You don't know because you've never developed a sense of boundaries or a sense of right and wrong or a sense of identity or a sense of how you should be treated as a person or a sense of what you want relative to what other people want from you. So I started working, and my boss started taking advantage of me. He was about 6 years older than me, and I don't mean sexually, and I don't mean physically, but he started saying, well, I need you to work an extra shift, and I'll pay you really well. You know, when you're 16 and you've never had anything, that's a lot of promise. And then we started dating. And once we started dating, then I didn't have a choice because it was like, listen, you're my girlfriend. I need you. We're shorthanded. You need to work. And, you know, I was afraid to say no. Again, I didn't know how to have boundaries. And soon, very soon after, I started living with him because it wasn't good where I was living with these people. They kept stealing my clothes and, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. Where I go home, I'd be going on a date, and my clothes weren't there. They were gone. I bought shampoo. They all used up the shampoo. The shampoo's not there, right? I'm the only one that had a job, or the other woman had a job, but she didn't share her clothes. She had her own bedroom and locked her shampoo up. So it was that sort of thing. So he talked me into living with him. Didn't charge me rent, but guess what? I could never say no to him. Now, I lived with him. I worked with him. I was 17. What did I know, right? The girls at work, they didn't necessarily like me in the beginning because it was like a Irish working class clique over there. They were all Irish girls, and they were friends with each other, and there was like a ringleader, and she didn't like the fact that he didn't hire me through her. I walked in and I asked for an application. He took the application and hired me on the spot. Usually she recommended people into all her friends work there, right? But after a while, they figured out that I was dating him. And of course, he told me to deny it. So I had to lie about it. They started taking me under their wing and training me. And at one point, the older waitress, you know, she was probably 32, but to a 16, 17-year-old, that's ancient. She pulled me inside and said, "Are you using birth control?" And I said, "Oh, that's none of your business." And she said, "You better use birth control." And she wrote down the name of a clinic on a tissue, a napkin. And she said, "You need to go there tomorrow. No need to tell anybody. You just go there tomorrow." She was right, and I did. And then my boyfriend boss started acting funny. He started leaving early, a couple of nights a week, and I was like, They started speculating, because they knew we were dating, even though I wasn't allowed to talk about it. They started saying, wonder if he's got somebody on the side, because apparently he was that type of guy, and I didn't know that, because I was too young to see, but they knew that, right? They'd worked with him for years, right? So they knew him. After a couple of weeks of this, I was starting to get jealous, so I asked him. And I was kind of afraid to ask him because he's the type of guy, you ask him something that he would tell you to mind your own business. This was the early 70s, or the mid-70s. And in those days, guys thought they were mafiosos, like, you know, from the movies. So they thought they could act like that with women. All guys did. I didn't know any better. That's just how guys acted. But he surprised me. He says, "Penny, I've been born again. I'm going to church." And, of course, I didn't believe him. So the next time he went, he said, "Do you want a gum?" And I said, "Okay." I went just to see if he was really going to church. And he did. And we went. Unfortunately, it was a very, very damaging experience for me. Unfortunately. I know that there's many, many churches, many, many good churches, and many, many good Christians who love the Lord and want to help people. This particular church was very, very fundamentalist. It was all about rules. The more you gave up, the more holy you were. So here I was. Picture this. I've been away from home about a year, maybe. Remember, at home, I had nothing. No makeup, no clothes, no hairstyles, no freedom, no food, no job, no privileges. And I've been gone a year. And you know I went out and bought new clothes. And you know I got my ears pierced. And you know I was wearing makeup and high heels and tight jeans. And that's what we did in the 70s. That's just what we did. I drank, but never to get drunk. It was more like I was trying to act cool. I was trying to be a grown-up. But all of a sudden, I showed up at church, and people were asking me to ask the Lord into my heart. And I was like, "I don't know you." Kind of pressuring me each time I went. "I don't know you. I don't know. No, I'm fine. I'm just here with this guy. I'm fine." And they started talking to me about the way I dressed. And I was like, no. Not for me. Thank you. I'm just here with him. Thank you. You know, after like, I don't know, a few months, the pressure gets to you, right? Because it's a happy, joyous place. People are singing and praising the Lord. And there's piano and there's guitar, tambourines, and people are clapping. And people are walking the aisle. And, you know, people are crying. And, you know, there's lots of talk about unconditional love and the family of God and being part of the family. Don't you want to be part of the family of God? And don't you want to be part of this? And so eventually I walked the aisle. But I kind of walked it like, okay, to get it over. Like, okay, let's just get this over. What I didn't realize was it was sort of like the bait and switch. It was sort of like, oh, yeah, here's the package deal. You walk the aisle, that's just the beginning. And the next time I went, the pastor's wife pulled me aside and said, Penny, you need to dress modestly. Like, you need to wear a skirt. It's a sin to wear jeans. I'm like, sin to wear jeans? The word jeans even in the Bible? They didn't like that. They didn't like me saying that. And this went on makeup, jewelry, high heels, tight clothes. I literally didn't own a skirt. We didn't wear skirts. Went on and on and on. You know, I knew what was coming. I wasn't supposed to be living there. I knew that was coming. I knew that. That was fine. I eventually moved out. I got my own place. I was happy. It was great. But I wasn't allowed to listen to music, so I had to hide them behind so that he didn't see that I had records at my house. And I just felt like I wasn't even married yet. I was 17 years old, and somebody else was telling me what to do. And it's like intellectually I wanted to believe in God, and I thought I was saved, but I didn't want the rest of this stuff. I either wasn't ready or I wasn't saved. I don't know, right? But I didn't want that package. And a pastor called us to his house one Friday night, and he said, you guys are living in sin. You got to stop. And we said, well, she's not living. We're not living together anymore. And he pulled my husband aside into another room. He told me to wait there. They were gone a long time. They were gone 15, 20 minutes.
I want you to be mindful of the time because I want to make sure that whatever is really important to you, we're down to 15 minutes. And I want to make sure, and I wish we had more time, but I want to make sure that you get whatever main points right now because we have 15 minutes. I want you to have that time, so please.
Thank you. Thank you for that. The main point was always the same as this. I got myself into a situation where I was, again, in a situation where I was abused, dominated, not allowed to talk about my trauma, not allowed to feel, not allowed to be a person. I was in the fundamental church for absolutely. Thank you for remembering that. So the first thing that never happened to me, because the church believed that anything happened to you was God's will, therefore don't talk about your abuse. I personally don't even think they believed me. And I don't think my first husband believed it either. So I never, ever talked about it, right? The biggest thing that happened to me when I started going to therapy was my therapist was the first person that ever said to me, Penny, this is terrible that this happened to you. It was wrong. You were wronged. You were abused. And I'm so sorry. This should never happen to you. And nobody's ever said that to me. And I cried and cried and cried. And that in itself was the beginning of healing. And then what happened was I had to unbuild that damage, that voice inside where I was trained to think that I was worthless, stupid, bad, there must be something wrong with me, that she mistreated me. There's nothing wrong with me. It was always about her and her problems and her mother and their problems. So it's an ongoing process, and I've been in and out of therapy for 30 years. I go, I stop, I go, I stop. I read books about healing and recovery. There's a wonderful book called Trauma and Recovery by Dr. Judith Herman. Wonderful book. I read tons of books. I have a whole shelf full of books on recovery. I do insight meditation to be aware of my thoughts and my fears. I go to retreats. I talk to people about it. And most importantly, I wrote this memoir. I know it looks backwards on that. It's called Redeemed, a memoir of a stolen childhood. And I wrote it so that people would know that there is a possibility of healing and finding happiness after trauma, and that telling your story is empowering and healing. We abused people are kind of ashamed because we're taught by society to be ashamed if we're other, if we're different, if we're not normal. And of course, our abusers teach us to keep quiet. So we hide it. But hiding is very isolating. And we need people around us that tell us, you're okay. It's not your fault. It wasn't your fault. You're not wrong. It was them. And so I encourage people to find a therapist, a non-judgmental friend, and talk about it. Talk about your trauma. And read some books, not necessarily mine, but mine is out there. It's coming out in June. You can buy it anywhere books are sold. It's called Redeemed, a Memoir of a Stolen Childhood by Penny Lane. Available on Amazon, available at bookshops. Find a therapist and start talking about it. Find other people that will support you and hug you and tell you it's not your fault. But it is, unfortunately, our responsibility to make our lives better because nobody else can do it. And if you're harboring feelings about, well, I need to get back at them, forget it. Forget it. It won't make you happy. It won't make you whole.
I wanted to ask you before we close out, and thank you for sharing all that great information in your wonderful memoir. Have you forgiven this stepmom, and have you seen her since in her later years? Where are you with that in the forgiveness?
Good question. I saw her once. I saw her a few times after I moved out. She passed away very soon after I moved out to California to live with my brother. I didn't have the guts to ask her why, but toward the end of her life, she started giving me a lot of gifts, which I think was her way of saying, I'm sorry. I cannot say that I forgive her because what she did to me was horrific and affected my whole life, affected my relationships, all my relationships. But I will say that I've made peace with it. And the difference is I think I understand why she did it. And in case there's anybody on here who knows them, I'm taking a guess that she was mean to me because she was unhappy that she married a man who couldn't make her happy, who couldn't provide for her family, who was an alcoholic, that she herself was a cripple at a young age, and she married the first guy that made her an offer because she wanted to get out of her home, so she wasn't happy. I understand it. I don't agree with it. I don't forgive her necessarily. How I make peace with it.
And also many times culturally, you know, back in those days, you know, it wasn't considered abuse. Like today when we think about some of the things we've been through, I'm like, oh, man, I definitely was being abused. I had a fork thrown in my eye. I was bleeding all over the place. I went through some stuff, too, where at that time it was just like, just get whooping. That's just what it is. And especially when people are from different countries. And then, you know, sometimes when we look at the abuses and we look at their childhood, not to make excuses for this lady, but sometimes
their childhood was so crazy. They probably lost their mother also at an early age, or they were abandoned, or they were mistreated, and they were treated like a Cinderella, and then they turn around and repeat the abuse. So, you know, we're down to 3 minutes. I just want to know if you have any last words for the listeners that are on, anything you'd like to share before we close out?
I want to say that it has made me a better person. Facing my abuse, knowing that it wasn't my fault, I vowed to be kind, to be gracious, to be good to people, because you don't know. People are suffering. You could walk by somebody on the street. You don't know that they might be thinking about suicide. If you smile at them, if you're nice to them, if you help them out, if you could brighten up somebody's day. So you could go either way. You could become mean and bitter. You could become an alcoholic. Get help and live the best life you can. Be happy yourself. Forget about them. They're never going to change. Some of them will never admit they ever did anything wrong. Make yourself happy. Be happy. Give yourself the gift of joy and happiness. I'm grateful I got out. I'm grateful I was able to heal. And that's more important.
You know, you said you owe it to yourself. You have to do the work. You said that. So, you know, it wasn't our fault, but it is our responsibility to work on our healing. And so, again, we just want to thank you for joining us tonight on NASCA, Stop Child Abuse Now radio show. Your testimony was very powerful. And you were very transparent, so I know that your testimony, somebody was saved through that. And again, we hope to, you know, have you again, and welcome to the NASCA family. You're welcome to join on the panel and listen in when other guests call in anytime when you're available. We do this, I believe, I know we do it 2 times a week. We'll double check on the schedule. I believe it's on Wednesdays. Not sure the other day on Mondays. I'm not sure. But we'll double check on that and let you know. But again, thank you for coming on tonight. And it was a complete pleasure hearing your story. Can you just tell us the name of the book one more time? We're on a minute.
Redeemed. A memoir of a stolen childhood.
And they could find it on Amazon. And listen, y'all, it's hot off the press, okay? So we're getting it hot.
Thank you so much, Dr. Nancy.
It was a pleasure to be here. I'm honored that you asked me.
Yes, ma'am. Well, thank you for your time. We enjoyed having you, and thank you to the welcome to the family. And for everyone listening tonight, we just want to wish you all a good night. And stay safe. Again, if you see something, say something. We are the voice for the voiceless, and we will continue to share our testimonies. Have a good night, everyone.
Another tomorrow, 'cause that dawn was-